If you're ready to confront your destiny, if this is the moment that you've been praying for, tune in and listen to your cosmic cheerleader, Commander Lady Athena, for cosmic pep talks, for closet Christ. The show is the voice of the Ashtar Command. The call is for you to step forward into your greatness. Be listening on Wednesday. We have an appointment with destiny.
Greetings in the divine love of the one self that we are all embodiments of. This evening, our seminar topic is seeking and the end of suffering. So if you're ready, take a deep breath and feel where that breath stops. You'll find it stops right in the center of your chest. Realize that the divine presence is breathing you and is located right in that very point where the breath has stopped. Of course, you're continuing breathing, right? But just saying, notice that that place in between the in-breathing and the out-breathing is where you touch to your own God presence. It is said in the Vedas that the Atma, the Supreme Self, takes a form of a light, a flame, that dwells in the center of your heart, about the size of a thumb. And yet, according to the Vedas, it is the largest of the large and the smallest of the small. And moreover, that flame that some people call a spark begins as you awaken to who you are to expand until it engulfs your entire being. So meditate on that. Begin to realize that God is not outside. God is not just in a special incarnation. Call it an avatar, the Son of God, whatever you want to call that which is. But know that it is inside you. Not external. God is not external. God is not outside you. God dwells within you. You are a temple. The body is a temple. You are the God presence that is the light dwelling in your heart. That's a bit of a stretch for most of us, conditioned as we have been in the West. But it is nevertheless absolutely true. We need to train our mind to the awareness that we are in God all the time, and God is within us all the time. So, the topic, seeking the end of suffering. Words, seeking and the end of suffering. I guess we seek a lot, don't we? Because we're suffering. You know what? That suffering is a good thing. Why? Because it means that you're ready to seek the end of suffering. And if you seek the end of suffering, you will most definitely find it. But let me ask, who is the seeker? What is it that would seek? Well, it would be the mind, wouldn't it? that which knows certainly wouldn't seek, and that would be you as God. Your God self would not be seeking. So it's the mind that forgot. The mind that forgot. The eternal all-knowingness of the self. But let me ask, who are you? If I would ask you, who are you? I hope you wouldn't... Well, you probably would give your name and what you do. I mean, that's what we do in society. And that would be okay if you really knew who you were and what you really were and why you are. But generally, we do not identify ourselves as who we truly are. So with what do you identify as yourself? Your body? Your basic self? Your ego? Your mind? Your high self? What comes up for you when we ask you, who are you? That's the question you have to keep asking and asking and asking until the truth is realized. So, what are you seeking? You know, whatever you seek, you must find. Why is that? Because everything you seek indicates a longing of your heart, which absolutely must be fulfilled. Do you know that every desire and longing of your heart absolutely must be fulfilled? Why? Because as the Lord God, which is your true self, your word is law. Your word is like rubbing the genie, what do you call it, the magic lantern, and the genie pops out and fulfills your wishes. So it's very important to be very clear about what it is you're seeking, so that you don't waste time seeking things that are not worth seeking. So, except for a few God-realized beings, everyone is seeking something. Perhaps if you've lived long enough, you've noticed that you've sought different things throughout your life. Things, interests, cycles, they come and go because change is the constant here. Maybe when you were a child, you dreamt of becoming something, but later found out that that desire was placed with other things as you grew older. And I think that's the case with most of us. Sometimes when we discover what is required to fulfill that dream, we may decide that we're just not up to the demand. At one point, I wanted to become a veterinary surgeon. But when I looked at what I would have to do, the years I'd have to spend studying medicine, anatomy, biology, zoology, equinology, etc., I thought, you know what? I don't want to do that. I didn't like being in school. It was boring. That was the last thing I wanted to do was spend, golly, how many years? I forgot now how many, but way too many. So instead, I decided I would be a bareback rider in the circus. You know, one of those people that jumps on and off horses and stands on their back and does somersaults and all that stuff. But you know, after I'd spent 7 and some years doing that, I outgrew the interest of that entirely. It just fell away. It's like, God, you got to be nuts to make your living doing this. And I realize, too, when you get older, you end up with a dog and pony act, where you become a ringmaster to other riders. And who wants to do that? So I passed through many different cycles. For a little while, I wanted to be a dancer, and so I joined a dance company. And after about 5 years of that, I thought, God, I really hate rehearsing 16 hours a day and coming home with bloody feet and blisters, and everything hurt, always. It's such a painful way to make your living. It was punishing. And then you have to starve yourself practically so that you're thin enough to be acceptable to be hired, which for me was always a challenge because I had chubby thighs. So after a while, that interest, gosh, that completely vanished. And then I married a minister, thinking that, oh gosh, ministers really love God. And then I found out it was just a business where you make money. And there was really no interest at all in discovering the self. I really didn't know there was a self to be discovered at that point. But I just knew that that was not it, and so that fell away. And so, one after another, the lesser desires fell away. And maybe it's been that case with you too. So the actual demands that whatever your desire would call you to fulfill, as well as the lifestyle that whatever that desired dream would entail, you know, you have to look at that. For example, many, many young children say they'd like to be a doctor when they grow up, but when they look at what it is to be a doctor or a surgeon, and how you would have absolutely no life at all but being up to your elbows in gore if you're a surgeon, hour after hour after hour, digging in somebody's innards. I mean, you know, you got to really be called to that, to want to pursue that. I remember there was a time when I was dating a surgeon, and he said one night, he said, you know, I just got to keep cutting and cutting and cutting. That's how I make my living. And I stopped dating him at that point, as you could imagine. But that's the fact of it, you see. So, as you've matured and gotten to know yourself better, maybe what you were really seeking was a way to help people. That was the case with me. When I was 10 years old, I went to the Cheyenne Frontier Days with my mom, and I saw a horse that broke its leg and was still bucking and jumping around on three legs. When he finally fell to the ground, they shot him and drug him off the arena. It totally traumatized me, and that was where the idea came into my mind to become an equine surgeon, so I could discover a way that they didn't have to put horses down when they broke a leg and their suffering. Which, of course, today they have. But that was, you know, many, many years ago, and I was 10 years old. So sometimes we get the idea we want to do something because really what we want to do is end suffering. We really want to help end suffering. And those of us who've come in that are very, very sensitive people, we're light workers, we're light bearers, we're here to make a difference in the world. Oh, my gosh. Behind all of that is such a desire to end suffering. You know, we're suffering, but more importantly, we see others suffer, and it causes us to suffer anguishes within our own being. That some of us feel we would do anything if we could just stop the war, stop the hatred, stop the bickering and the bigotry and all of the awful things we see on the evening news. Oh my God, if we could just stop that. And that's where most of us is coming from. So, God bless you. God bless us all. Because that is our heart. I just know it. I know that's our heart. So let's look at this thing, this suffering, what it is that suffers. Now, Lord Buddha was into that. For heaven's sakes, he was a prince, Prince Siddhartha, lived in a palace. Maybe you know the story, maybe some of you don't. His father kept him very carefully guarded so he would never see an old person, an aging person, a diseased person, a dying person. Never, never, never. Because when he was born, the astrologer said he would either become a great king like his father, or he would become a great sage and reach enlightenment. And of course, the kingly father wanted his son to follow in his footsteps, as most fathers in India do. And so he surrounded him with everything that could cater to his passions, his lusts, his desires, which actually he was the kind of guy that wasn't terribly into all of that because he had the nature already of a rishi within him. But he loved his young wife, and she had given birth to a son. But he was curious what was outside. Well, he was been in this walled-in palace compound all his life. And so he asked a very, very close friend of him, of his, if he could take him for a ride outside the palace. And cajoled him. I don't know how he did it, because I believe they were all under orders, but he cajoled him in some way. And so the young prince disguised himself and was able to sneak out. And for the first time, he saw disease and old age and suffering and death. And he said, "What is this? Does everyone go through that?" "Yes, Master, everyone goes through that, including you." And it was such a shock to him that that very night he left his young newborn son and his wife and went outside and never returned. And for 6 years he mortified his flesh. He ate so little and practiced such severe sadhanas that he was like a skeleton. But he wasn't any wiser. He still had no idea why people suffer, and much less why or how they could stop suffering. But finally he realized that being so severe was not the way, so he adopted a middle path. And after some time of, again, deep meditation, deep spiritual practice, he came to realize that the cause of suffering is clinging to impermanent things. Everything in the third-dimensional material universes declines, dissipates, and dies. Everything. Planets, suns, moons, everything you see in the sky when you look through a telescope goes through those same cycles. Everything has its time and the ending of that time. And as long as anything is caught in the noose of time and space, it has that material maya, that illusion. As all illusions do, they dissipate, decline, and dissolve. And so he realized it's clinging. It's trying to make things stay as they are. My gosh, everything in our world is about trying to maintain things as they are. Possessions, relationships, our successes, our valuables. You know, the minute you get a car, it depreciates tremendously the first week that you drive it. So everything is designed to dissolve and disintegrate and end at some point and return to the dust, return to the elements, including the physical body. Most of us identify very much with being this house of meat. You know, we would never think of identifying ourselves with our car. You sit in a car, right? You know it's just the vehicle. But we identify with this vehicle, this physical vehicle, forgetting it's simply a method to show up and move about in time-space on a physical planet. In this solar system, Earth is the only physical planet that has a human physical body. All the other planets have life, but it's at a higher level of dimension. So here we are, stuck in the meat body. But you know what? You only suffer when you think you are that meat body. When you identify with your senses, when you identify with the feedback of your senses and your nervous system, and your mental computer, your brain interpretation process, and your mind, which is just a bunch of memories and associations and attachments and aversions. That's all the mind is, a bunch of desires, wishes, and wants. When you don't identify with those things that are part of this world, you can transcend to the place that there's no pain. That's why yogis and advanced spiritual beings can go through all sorts of torturous things and not notice it. They don't notice their body. They're not identified with it. They live in a state above the body. And they see a world totally different because of that perspective. Well, what is it that experiences that transcendental state? That's you. That's you, the God Self. There is no other you. That person that you think is an individual persona, personality, is something your mind has made up. It doesn't exist. That's why when you lose that attachment to your body and your personality and your name and your game, you move into spacious awareness to where you're everywhere at the same time. You're all-knowing and you're all-powerful. You have moved from the little miserable prison ego self to the vast universal presence that is the God that you truly are. That's what's called God realization. You realize you're divine, you're God, you're immortal, you're whole. There's no becoming that. You are that already. I was watching a story of a nun the other day, a Buddhist nun, spent 12 freaking years in a cave, snowed in on the top of the Himalayas. And she was a Westerner. And she was seeking perfection. Ah, good Lord in heaven. She's seeking what she's always had and always been. Seeking perfection. What tortures we put ourselves through to find what we've always been. Well, if that isn't crazy, what is? But I guess we all have to do what we do until we don't. We all come in with ingrained tendencies from our past lives, points of familiarity. We go like little homing pigeons back in the similar rabbit tracks that we traced in previous lives. Why in the world did Sai Baba have me born in a Western female body? A rather dishy-looking one, if I must say so, that ended up, you know, with two contracts offered by major studios, MGM and Warner Brothers, was discovered as early as the age of 3, ended up joining the circus, ended up dancing in Las Vegas and doing aerial performances in those big showrooms on the Strip. What an incarnation to give me after 4 lifetimes as a guru in India. I find that hilarious. Wasn't so funny at first when I discovered Sai Baba. You know, I lamented that I was in a female body and I was born in America. Now I'm really grateful because he had to break that pattern. mean, the minute my parents put me in Catholic school, boarding school, I wanted to become a nun. That was so natural for me. As soon as I went to India, I wanted to live in Sai Baba's ashram for the rest of my life. I was longing for that, crying for it, pestering him nonstop for that. But fortunately, he had married me already, married me off, and I had a 10-year-old daughter, so I couldn't exactly do that. So I'm just saying that these are really divine blessings that God has given us to be where we are and what we are, and that you could listen to these things that we're sharing each week, for heaven's sakes. Where else are you going to get this kind of information? How many people have been able to have the direct experience of living with a God-realized avatar, a cosmic avatar? And so he says that when you have genuine divine experience, it's your duty, your dharma, to share it. So that's what I'm sharing. They're teachings that I was given through many years of being with Sai Baba. Now many of you will have a chance to be with him as he comes back as Prema Sai Baba. So keep your eyes open, because he's right now growing up a little body. At least that's what I'm understanding to be the case. And no, you're not going to find him if you go searching for him. It's not about that. It's not about trying to find an outer God form anymore or following a guru outwardly anymore. The whole message of Prema Sai Baba will be, you are God. Sai Baba's message is the father motherhood of God and the brother sisterhood of mankind. That's his message. He came to lay in the foundation for the golden age that Prema Sai will preside over. Okay? But Prema Sai is not, as far as I know, going to be a guru that you can go and put your power onto and you project yourself, you know, in a inferior position. He's not going to allow that, so far as I know. So, just about everything you see in the media is targeted to alleviate suffering. All the pharmaceutical things that are touted, all of the entertainment, excuse me, consider this. The whole entertainment industry is designed to give you relief from suffering by watching others suffer, you know, so you identify with them, you forget your own. But more importantly, it's to take your mind off your problems and your worries and your troubles. And for an hour, two, three, 4 hours, whatever it is that you're involved with that movie or TV program, you forget your suffering. You're out of your mind. You're out of your physical drama. You're just enjoying the program. For example, I think a lot of you may watch The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. And it's so interesting that you totally forget while you're watching that show that, well, you just are so into that you don't think about anything else. And so it gives you pleasure, it gives you joy, it gives you respite from your monkey mind and its constant conjuring up of problems and worries and difficulties. That's your monkey mind, your ego mind. It's busy nonstop trying to point out the things you have to be worried about, afraid of, protect yourself from. Well, isn't it? I mean, really, think about it. All of the silly little beliefs that we have that certain things will protect us, like pushing some sort of animal serum in our arms will protect us from disease. Or if we don't have a bunch of money, we have no security. Or if we don't have someone that adores us and does everything that we want them to do, we're not worthy, we're not loved. I mean, it goes on and on and on. All of these useless 10,001 things that we project onto some sort of an importance that it really doesn't have. nor does it have an iota of security. Because I tell you, when you realize that part of yourself that is identical with God, you cease being dependent upon anything outside of yourself. You get to a point where there is no one that you trust more than your own self. There's just no one. You will trust your own knowing above that of anyone else. And that's the way it's meant to be. So you can't depend on anything in the outer world but your own self, which is all-sufficient. I know I'm like reciting the menu to people who are hungry, but I'm speaking out of my own direct experience. So at least it has the conviction of a person who has been through the gamut of beliefs and belief systems and spiritual practices, which, by the way, Sai Baba says it's all mental nonsense. All these visualizations and stuff that we do, it's all mental mood making. You know, sorry to say that, but gosh, I remember John Roger, and I had just found him as my teacher 45 years ago. And the first thing he said to me was to quit being loyal to spiritual practices that I had long since outgrown. I hadn't a clue what he meant then, but now I sure recognize it. So it takes a while for, you know, for the things that our teachers tell us, for the things that we read and study. It has to get worked through every part of our consciousness until it lands in certitude. It has to land in certitude. But I tell you, if you don't have any self-confidence, which I didn't have as I came into any of this, you got to develop that. And you develop that by constantly going inside to that part of you that we touch into every time we take a deep breath. And land that understanding inside yourself. You got to do that. It can't be given to you by anybody else. So part of our suffering is good because it we're going to find a way to try to stop the pain, okay? There's going to be a point in which you say, I can't stand this anymore. I've got to do something. I think it was Eckhart Tolle that got to the point. He was suicidal, and he said, I just can't live with myself anymore. And that was such a bizarre statement for him to make. It shot him up into the higher awareness, and he said, who in the world is that self that I can't live with? Does that mean I have two selves? And look at the incredible ministry that's coming out of Eckhart Tolle now, based on that realization. Of course, he had to work it through, you know. I think he spent a year or something on park benches contemplating and mulling over that and getting it down in his sneakers, as I like to say. So it's one thing to have a realization, but it's another thing to get that to where it becomes your natural state of consciousness. That's the difference between being initiated, which is a nice ritual. You get a nice mantra. You say your mantra, all of that. But until you start acting as an initiate, that is, bringing yourself into greater awareness, greater light, greater understanding, which takes a lot of work, I have to tell you. You got to work it until it's your natural state. Your natural identity has been shifted from your miserable little prison ego to the omnipresent divine presence of love that you are. That takes work. We're all a little lazy. We would like somebody to do it for us. We'd like that guru who initiated us to be able to go inside and just rearrange the furniture and, you know, do whatever. But you know what? Any teacher, I don't care who they are, can only point direction. But you have to work out your own salvation, as it says in the Bible. We work out our own salvation through fear and trembling. I think the word fear probably means diligent, reverential watching where you're putting your feet. I don't think it's being afraid. I think it's that pushing through and constantly exercising awareness, the awareness you have at the moment, to make the best use of your time. I think that's what that fear means. And trembling, oh my God, when you get to certain stages of higher vibration, your whole body vibrates. It trembles because that power that you're integrating, which is you getting into your physical vehicle, really puts a strain on the nervous system and you tremble. Did you ever have where your solar plexus starts to tremble and you start shaking inside your core, inside your belly, and sometimes your teeth will even chatter? That happens because an emotional energy from the astral plane is impacting your third chakra, and it's a higher vibration than that chakra is used to integrating, and it causes that shaking. Sometimes when you have a really powerful realization spiritually or something deeply impacts you. I remember when I was very, very young, I went to see a great Indian medicine woman, Dayani Yahoo Fisher, I believe her name is, still alive. I remember my whole body shook. My face was shaking. My mouth, my eyes were jittering. My body from head to toe was shaking as I entered into her aura. I was very embarrassed at the time. But now I understand it was that powerful auric field I was entering. So we go through these stages of conditioning to where we are strengthened enough to stand the power of our own integration, our own spiritual occupancy that displaces and dissolves that lesser, lower, false point that we have clung to as our identity. We move in and occupy our physical, emotional, mental vehicles. And that takes that conditioning that comes with constant and consistent spiritual practice. You got to hold your feet to the fire all the time, all the time. That's called discipleship. That's called commitment. That's called hunger. Boy, if you're not hungry for the higher spiritual things, you know, if you're trying to talk to somebody that's content with his beer and his boob tube, or her kids and her grandkids and her potluck suppers, forget it. They're not ready. Just forget it. When a person is hungry, they're going to find that food. And I'm talking here about soul food. I'm talking about that which has the power to really shift your worldview, really upturn your apple cart, really mess with what you thought was your reality. You got to mess with it. Because it's not real, and the reason it's not real is because it's causing you suffering. And you are bliss itself. Your natural self is bliss, paramananda. There isn't even a word in English to describe that state. I just don't even have words to begin. But I'll tell you, when you're in bliss, there is absolutely no awareness of a body, of a mind, of a question, of a doubt, of an otherness. And it's worth everything to seek that above all else. I would say there's degrees of seeking. For example, for many lifetimes, we probably are very content with the things of the world. We're not very experienced here. What is it? Your consciousness. What is your consciousness? It's a soul that has yet to be experienced in the reincarnational cycles. And so they keep coming back, life after life, to enjoy the things of the animal nature, let's say, because all animals eat, sleep, mate, and defend their property, and reproduce. And so the animal man, you know, that's not ready for the occupancy of the real self, the soul self, spends many lifetimes functioning under the biophysical urges of the material elemental. That would be the David being that forms the physical body, takes care of it. It's not you, it's just a little, like a little body angel, if you would. It's not really an angel, it's an elemental, it's not conscious. Does it suffer? No. I found out that basic cells don't suffer. And when I really looked at it, I said, well, basic cells are very immature, elemental spirits on their way to evolving to where they can have a first human embodiment. Most of them come out of the animal kingdom. That's why you find people that have animal characteristics. They maybe have just evolved, not them as a soul, their physical body. Okay, we're talking about a body now. Evolved out of the elements of earth, wind, fire, water, and ether, usually in the case of a human being, an animal, another life form. And so they are evolving to the stage to where they can take their first incarnation as a, quote, human being, with, of course, the awareness to become self-aware. A human being is different from an animal because an animal doesn't know they're an animal. They don't know they're an animal, and they don't know that they're not aware of the self, divine. They operate through instinct, although some of them are very highly evolved now and are getting ready to take their first incarnation. Sai Baba's elephant, Sai Gita, he said, would be born as a woman in her next lifetime. And so on. So some of the domestic animals that we have very close to us will be taking their very first incarnation as a human being. So they're evolving along what's called the elemental and the Devic evolution. They're part of that evolution. The soul, on the other hand, is not part of that. The soul is the consciousness which you become more and more awakened to until you become self-conscious, first as, you know, I'm a human being and you live a personality-driven life. And then you awaken beyond that to the fact that, oh, I'm not the body, I'm the soul. And then at some point you outgrow the soul too and you move into the monadic or the I am presence, which would be the real spirit or the real God self that you are at an even higher level. So everything is moving up to the next stage, so to speak. And it has to do with the material elementals that work through the material forms. All of the forms that you see are comprised of many little lives that coalesce as that particular form. For example, there are trillions of little fire elementals that make up your causal and your astral bodies. Trillions of little beings that are evolving because of your emotional template. Oh, it's a wonderful thing. You know, everything is within you. There is nothing in the universe that is not inside you. And that's why the best study of God is your own self. The best study of life. You know? It's where you begin to open your eyes beyond the visible world and you begin to see the more subtle levels of life. And that keeps increasing. There are things right now in the room around you that are so breathtakingly gorgeous. Well, you'd go into instant bliss if you could see some of these things. But we need to deal with what's present here and now and train our nervous system to absorb and be able to hold with higher vibrational states. So one of the causes of pain, aside from identifying yourself with your physical body, is the disparity between the material vibration and the high vibration of the soul. And it's the friction between those two energies that causes your spiritual progression. It's called a fire by friction, which is the physical, and the solar fire, which is you as a solar angel, as we spoke about in one seminar. The friction between those two vibrations. And so you have a middleman, so to speak, that is a composite of those two vibrational states, which we could call the human being, the human vehicle, which suffers indeed because there's like a battle that goes on between the material self and the spiritual energies. And that battle causes you to go through pain and friction. So the integrative process then psychologically becomes even painful. But if you look at that in the Vedic point of view, this is what would be called tapas. And your spiritual sadhana, your spiritual practice, involves the homogenization or the wedding, if you will, of that higher part of you that is the soul with that part of you in the visible world that looks like a human being walking around. It's an integrative process. John Roger calls it the spiritual wedding, where you marry that higher nature with your personality in the physical world and basically make peace with it, live in harmony, be present with it. Honor it for what it is. Look, you worked through probably 150 million lifetimes to get to the point that you could have a human body. That's a lot of incarnations and a lot of different forms to get to where you said, okay, I'm going to go for a human body this time. I want to experience self-consciousness. I want to have the opportunity to awaken as my God self. And so when you get hungry enough and suffer enough, because if you don't suffer, you're never ever going to look beyond the body, okay? You're never going to look beyond it. You have to suffer or you're going to just think it's just peachy cream down here. Gosh, isn't it wonderful? I don't know a single spiritual person that is not in some form of spiritual anguish and travail. I mean, if you're a saint like Saint Teresa or Mother Sharada, the wife of Sri Ramakrishna, how they suffered. John Roger, how he suffered. Sai Baba, oh my heavens. He didn't suffer for himself. He had no body consciousness. But he would take on the sufferings of his devotees that he knew would not be able to survive the pain, that he knew would be dead from the stroke or the heart attack or whatever. Sai Baba took on all of that stuff, one after another after another. John Roger did too. He said one time that he had as many as 40 diseases raging in his body at any given time. For himself, no, he wasn't attached to his body. The people he was working with. So there's a suffering at a very high level that bodhisattvas and avatars and great spiritual masters undergo who are on the ray of teaching, who are on the ray of being a guru. And the guru means one who leads you from darkness to light, from the unreal to the real, from death to immortality. And when we speak about immortality, it has nothing to do with your physical body. Immortality is something you already have. Now, these people have very unrealistic ideas about what it means to be immortal. You are immortal right now. What about ascended masters? They have gone through a complete transfiguration of the physical carbon-based molecular atoms to a higher vibrational etheric or astral body. Sometimes they move into the astral realm at the lowest level, which makes them visible, but still they're in a higher dimension. Sometimes they create a Maya Virupa, which is a body that is created out of meditation, out of thought. Some of them overshadow or overlight a disciple, work through them, which is what the Lord Maitreya did with the Master Jesus. He overlighted him and worked through him. But that high level has not even been attained by many of the masters. Not everyone has attained the sixth initiation, which is the ascension initiation. So when we talk about the shift of the ages and mix it up with floating up in the air in some form of rapture, I mean, who floats up in the air in some form of rapture? Maybe some yogis, but they don't stay in the air. They come down. So if you have a physical body, you don't stay up in the air. So what is it, this great catching away in the spirit? It's soul transcendence. It's moving your inner awareness into your own Christship. It's being caught up in your own divine awareness. You're not going to drop your clothes like those movies showed and, you know, disappear out of your car. In fact, if you would know it, many of you are in the state of rapture now. You experience it regularly. You get caught up in the spirit to where you completely lose sight of this world and this suffering and this body. That was what happened to the apostle or the disciple Paul. He said, I die daily. What does that mean? It means to die to this fictional world that we dream, you see, and be caught up in the spiritual perspective of oneness with God. So many of us are going into that state. I definitely am. Have been for some years now. And many of you are as well. So look around you and realize that every single thing you see and everyone you see, you're going to have to at some point say goodbye forever on this dimension to them. But not to worry. Because they are all parts of you. There's only one divine self that inhabits the collective. And so within the illusion field, within the many bardos and states of consciousness we have created for ourselves, we meet our loved ones as we knew them on Earth. But when you awaken fully, you realize that everything that you have loved is your own self. And it's with you eternally. Never any separation. You find it all within your own self. There's no place else to look. So another word for suffering is to endure. And John Roger has told all of us who are his initiates that we must endure to the end. We must endure all things to the end. And if we would know God, we must first know that that reflection, when we look in the mirror and we look into our eyes, is God. The one who is seeing the reflection in the mirror is God. When we look at our loved ones or anyone and look deep into their eyes, you're seeing God. Because God is living inside and looking out of those eyes. And as you contemplate the spiritual teachings, and you must contemplate them, if you just listen, goes in one ear and out the other. You must practice at least one spiritual teaching all the time, consistently. It doesn't take a box full of matches to light a fire, but you have to take at least one. And whatever that is, you practice it all the time. I asked Sai Baba what I should practice, and he kept opening me to the scene in the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's chapter 10, where Krishna gives Arjuna the vision of himself being everything and everyone. And it was a great shock to Arjuna, who had simply considered Krishna to be his charioteer. So, that has been my practice for many decades, is to see God in everything, every form. And it was interesting, you know, when I was with Sai Baba, I had so many people that would come up and say, "You look just like Sai Baba. You're just like Sai Baba." And they say you become like that which you focus on. And after a while, I began to look at him when I would watch the films of him, or sometimes when I'd watch him moving around in darshan. And the mood would come upon me that I was watching myself. I don't look at all like Sai Baba. I have never looked like Sai Baba. But it was an experience I had that I thought was quite... Afterwards, you know, at the time you don't think anything about it, but afterwards I think, well, that's kind of strange. But now I realize it's one of those experiences that come as you're integrating your own divine presence. You know, you become a devotee of someone, in my case, a devotee of Sai Baba, student of John Roger. But at some point, if your master is a true one, which these two happen to be, you will find that you're looking at yourself. The master is simply a mirror for you to see yourself more clearly. That's all they are. And then you come to the realization that everything in your life is a mirror. It's part of your spiritual practice. It's showing you something that's very useful. Spirit is always showing you something. There's never a second that something isn't going on. So realize that suffering is part of our spiritual learning here in the physical dimension. We're here to learn godlike love. That's it. And when we have totally come into a state where we unconditionally love everything without discrimination, seeing the good and the divine only in everyone and everything, we graduate. And we move on to higher planetary and solar schools. But in our solar system, the Earth planet is the only place designated to master unconditional love. And that's why we're here. And we will suffer as long as there is a difference that we perceive. And that's what keeps us seeking. So I hope this has been helpful to you. Let's go out chanting a nice long Anahi. Deep breath. Blessings and grace to each one of you. Namaste.